Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast.
Well, this is Dick Staub back with you. We're enjoying a good show of the Kindling's Muse live from Fremont, which is not in California. It's the center of the known universe right here in Seattle, Washington. We've got a great panel with us tonight, Greg Wolf, Heather Hawkins, and Brian Burton. We've been talking about irreligious Seattle, and we've got a lot of interesting comments from our live audience, and we want to start getting to some of them. I'm going to try to combine three people here and let each of you kind of tag on each other. Well, maybe two of them here to start. Pam, table 11, back in the back there, Pam Nolte. You say Seattle's well known as a city of tolerance. Is it possible that we hold back from community or deeper relationships to stay away from places where disagreement or intolerance might rear its head? And then Susie Burke at table 5 had a similar comment, raising the question whether Seattle's really individualistic or is it an issue of politically correct? And what's the difference? Let's start with Pam and then Susie, and then maybe the panel can pipe up.
I love the thought that our city is a tolerant city, but I do wonder if it keeps us from a place of community where we're willing to get into conversations where we might discover we're not as tolerant as we think we are, or that other person might discover they're not as tolerant as they think they are, and have the conversation stop because we don't want to take it to that place where conversation gets uncomfortable and hard, but actually becomes true dialogue.
Interesting. And Susie, at table 5, if you could kind of add on to that, anything you wanted to mention?
I'm afraid that I run into way too many of the go-along, get-along guys, and my sense in my town, because I grew up here, is that... As long as you're saying the right things, we're a real tolerant place. But we're not terribly tolerant to the wide variety of places people come from. And community, we talk about as neighborhoods. We love our neighborhoods until somebody really wants to be individual about their neighborhood. And then you've got the fight on your hands. So my sense is I'd rather see us a little more open to the discussion.
Interesting, okay. Anybody in the panel want to tag onto those comments about community, individuality, political correctness, and the discomfort that comes with actually having conversations where you say to somebody, I don't agree with you?
Well, here's the paradox. People talk about tolerance as being a virtue of understanding and a virtue of openness and a virtue of gentleness. And yet, oftentimes, it is precisely a kind of code word for what we all believe, those of us who are enlightened. The irony, the paradox to me is that sometimes people who really use the word truth, though they may be seen to be the ones who are the most incendiary. How dare you talk about truth? You know, it's my truth versus your truth. But I think in the end, in the big picture, if you're willing to sit there and actually passionately argue about truth rather than tolerance, you're going to get someplace. Because when you talk about truth, you are caring passionately about something. You want to get someplace. And you can do it through dialogue if you want to. You know, you can assert it and kill it, or you can do it through dialogue. So I think, you know, in a way, starting from tolerance is kind of giving up the game right from the outset. Whereas you need to start from truth. As long as it's not truth from on high, my truth, or the highway, or what have you. But there needs to be some belief that what we say has some transcendence of ourselves.
Hmm. I mentioned Martin Marty earlier, and when we were talking about the idea for this show, and he brought up the word hospitality, he had just written a book, and if any of you know him, he's a prolific author, and he said, in American society, tolerance has come to mean, I want you to believe as little as I believe so we can get along. And he said, the issue is not tolerance, it's hospitality. It's the ability to break bread with people that you disagree with, have open conversations, and I'll say it exactly the way Marty said it to me. He's a Lutheran clergyman. He said, if I'm inviting a Jewish or Muslim friend to my home, I'm not going to serve pork. I am not going to pray in the name of Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior. But I'm also not going to take the cross off my wall. You know, I hold and believe certain things to be true, and I expect my guests do as well, but we're still going to break bread together, and I'm going to be sensitive, but we're going to enjoy a meal. Are we getting any consensus around this issue of kind of political correctness and tolerance being the operative word here in Seattle?
Well, I think somewhere in our conversations, whether they're religious or political or any place else, we've lost the art of persuasion. That part of the engagement, there was this understanding that we could have this civil conversation. I mean, you're talking about Adams and Jefferson when we opened the show, and theologically, I can look at two great theologians of the 20th century, Barth and Brunner, who, again, in the midst of Nazi Germany, kind of went at each other about everything they believed, and yet somewhere it was the exchange of ideas in writing, in conferences, in conversation, that in the end of the day there was this civil understanding of persuasion that was part of this pursuit of deeper understanding that could actually lead to a more civil engagement that's so missing right now. It doesn't have to be coercion. I'm not talking coercion. I'm talking the art of persuasion as part of our dialogue and conversation. That's okay.
What extent does that get back to Greg starting with the word truth? I mean, if you first of all don't believe there's such a thing as truth, then the idea that you can persuade someone else of anything through reason is kind of problematic. But we also have an education system that basically is built around the principle that we affirm each person's right to hold their own belief and their own truth. And we've gotten to the place where many people are unable to discern that someone else's belief or opinion actually does count more than theirs because they know something about the subject. As opposed to, I interviewed Marlo Morgan. This is an amazing story. She was a woman who was a Midwest farm woman. She claimed to have been mysteriously reached by Aborigines at her farmhouse in Iowa. They invited her to come to Australia. She went to Australia. She met them at the airport. She stripped to a loincloth. Anyone lived in the Midwest? Can you see the Midwest farm woman stripping to a loincloth? She traveled with them for 6 months. She got back and wrote a book called Mutant Message Down Under, which no publishers wanted to publish. She wrote the book. It sold 300,000 copies as a self-published book. A major publisher said, we want to publish it, but we need to verify that this story is true. They sent people out in Australia to get affidavits, and even the people she said she had met said they had never heard of her. And they came back and said, Marlo, we're going to have to publish this as fiction. And she says, well, that's okay. What's true for you is true for you, and what's true for me is true for me. It's like you go into a bookstore these days and it's fiction, nonfiction, not sure. If you live in a not sure civilization, then reason and discourse and persuasion really don't have a place.
Well, see, that's still part of the whole conversation between modern and postmodern. To me, we're still living in the shadow of Kant. There's certain things that even in our educational system, it's not up for debate whether 2 + 2 = 4. It's when we start talking, again, in the realms of spirituality, of religion, and again, under the face of ideology, that those are the things that we say are up for grabs. Those are subjective understandings. We're still living under that dichotomy that Kant said, we know certain things this way to be true, these other things are up for grabs, and we're still living in that. Whether we want to call ourselves modern or postmodern, we're still living in the shadow of that Kantian dichotomy that we still haven't worked ourselves on.
Well, you know, in the West, we used to talk about the three transcendentals, the three ultimate things in the universe: truth, which we've already talked about, goodness and beauty. Now, truth, goodness, and beauty are things that people from any tradition can talk about. But I would argue that even now, even those things are problematic. That beauty is assumed automatically, for example, as subjective. There could be no such thing in beauty. You know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, is the old saw there. So, you know, it's a tough situation that we have to deal with when even the transcendentals, as they were called, the things that transcended our individual ethnic and geographical backgrounds, are things that themselves are difficult to talk about, because we'd really rather say, I tolerate this general position that you have, without really trying to understand what it means in the first place.
Greg, one of our folks here tonight, Scott at Table 12, asked about the ways that you see art revealing the spiritual desire of Seattleites, and how are religious institutions dealing with this and with art?
Well, to me, at the heart of all great art is a language that's different from the language of reason, different than the language of polemics, different than the language of explanation, or different than the language of science. It's a language of the intuition and the imagination. And the great thing, I think, about art and imagination in our current context, and don't get me wrong, I'm not doing down reason or science, because I think they're great values, but we live in a society where those things are deeply conflicted at the moment, and frankly, where political language has become so ideological and abstract that the notion of a rational discourse has really been called into question. Art has a way of leaping over all those pricklinesses, all the culture war nostrums, all the sort of, you know, talking points that each side has worked up. Art is a place where people can meet in a space where precisely there is a kind of openness. There is a kind of, art opens you up. It has an element of mystery to it, an element of ambiguity to it. Not that it doesn't care about truth, but that it recognizes that in human life, truth is a difficult thing to find. And I would say that art precisely reminds us that finding truth together is tough, and that we have to navigate our way through the shoals of all the different ways we can go wrong. And sometimes what art does is take the edges off both sides of the ideological extreme and show where you've missed the point. And sometimes there's a kind of wise golden mean that art can bring us to. And I think what art generates is a passion for mystery, a passion for something that transcends what we can control, what we know. We long for the infinite. We long for something more. And art these days is one of the few places where that desire of our hearts can be awakened, and many people can come together along those lines. And that's certainly one reason why in what I do, I devote myself to the arts, because it's a language that has a way of providing a shared space which people can enter into beyond those barriers that automatically get erected in other venues, other scenarios.
And by the way, let me mention, I mentioned that Greg is the editor of Image Journal, and at the end of our show tonight, you'll be able to see a copy of the magazine. And Wednesday night, in a program that is open to the public at 7:30, Image Journal is bringing Kathleen Norris to Seattle, who will be doing a reading at St. Mark's at 7:30 p.m. on Wednesday night. And it's a great, great opportunity for those of you that would like to come into the presence of someone who's been doing some very interesting thinking.
Can I follow up part of that question?
Yeah, yeah, and I need to ask you to add to your comment. Somebody asked you about your glimmers of hope, where you see glimmers of hope these days. But go ahead and tag on to Greg, and then maybe bring us some hope.
Okay, well, I'm tagging on to Greg's comment, though. I mean, I think what's interesting is that I heard Barbara Nicolosi speak at a benefit earlier, at Taproot Theater's benefit for their 25th anniversary dinner, and she was talking about, you know, years ago, when you asked someone who the patron of the arts was, people would always answer the Christian church. You know, and if you ask now who the patron of the arts is, Washington Mutual or Boeing or KeyBank, you know, to sponsor, you know, an event or a painting exhibit at SAM. And something to me that I find really interesting is I want to know really what's happening artistically in churches. I mean, I know a little bit about what's happening in my church. I know a little bit about what's happening in French churches. But sometimes I still feel like we lower the bar sometimes artistically for in churches. And I mean,
Don't get me started.
I mean... And I feel like we have such a rich tradition of the arts as being this like incredible wealth of power and mystery and like incredible expression, whether it's performing arts or visual arts or literature. And I feel in some ways that we've lost that tradition.
But part of the problem, isn't it, that art is like the last
the last stronghold of the prophets. Artists are crazy enough to actually tell the truth and say what they see. And I think that's really uncomfortable for a lot of religious institutions.
Oh, yeah.
We'd rather, it's back to the go along to get along church, you know? And if you're gonna bring art into the church, you gotta expect some messiness, because art takes us to the messy places. By the way, Jesus also did.
Well, one of the places I grew so much in this, because the Protestant tradition just messed it up. I'll be real honest. I mean, as a Protestant, you know, again, the church was. And we got rid of all of it. We were afraid that image would be automatically associated with idolatry. And what a tragic mistake that is, that needs to be redeemed in the Protestant tradition more than almost anything I know of needs to be redeemed. And as you start to look at it, again, part of it is this. I remember years ago, a friend, Mako Fujimura, took me into the Museum of Art in New York City. And one of the most profound things he did, because this wasn't a place of concern for me. And he said, I'm gonna show you how to really do this. And my view was, I looked at art and said, whether I liked it or not. That's the way, for the minimalist training I got, I get to judge whether I like it or not. And if I don't like it, I keep walking. And Mako gave a very good insight. He said, instead of you doing to the art, let the art do to you. And to me, that is as spiritual engagement as you can get, not only in art, but as spiritual reality if you really believe in God, that it's not all about me doing unto God, but allowing God to act upon me. And to me, that's one of the great interchanges here that we can build upon.
And now look what happened. Great. Good comments. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with Robert Diebel, who's going to bring us some art in just a minute. Don't go away. We'll be right back with the Kindling's News.